Well, good morning to each of you this morning. Not sure if I've got only half hour or a whole half hour, but we'll see. A smart person learns from their mistakes. A wise person also learns from the mistakes of others. And that's what we're going to do this morning. We are going to be, as I've titled the message, Learning from the Mistakes of Saul. In my studying, I came across multiple times that Saul made mistakes or failed. Some of them, in 1 Samuel 10:21, right off the bat, he was hiding when it was time to make him king. He was in fear of being coronated. In 1 Samuel 13:10, he didn't wait for Samuel to come before he attacked the heathens. I forget which one it was. 1 Samuel 14:24. Also before an attack, he placed the people under an oath not to eat or drink until the end of the day. 1 Samuel 15:9, he disobeyed God by sparing the best of the livestock and the king Agag. In 1 Samuel 17:11, him and all the people were terrified of Goliath and the Philistines. 1 Samuel 18:8, we read about him being envious of David. In 1 Samuel 22, we read about when he was pursuing David, he murdered the priests. And also in 1 Samuel 28, he consulted a medium or a spiritist. And so we're going to be looking at several of these, three if my time holds. We'll start out with 1 Samuel 15:1-31. I should mention I'll be going through a lot of scripture this morning. It's going to be up to you whether you want to follow along or just listen to me. If it was me, I'd follow along. 1 Samuel 15, starting at verse 1. In my book, in my Bible, the chapter is titled, The Lord Rejects Saul as King. Samuel said to Saul, I am the one the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people Israel. So listen now to the message from the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty says. I will punish the Amalekites for what they did to Israel when they waylaid them as they came up from Egypt. Now go, attack the Amalekites, and totally destroy everything that belongs to them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. So Saul summoned the men and mustered them at Telaim, 200,000 foot soldiers and 10,000 men from Judah. Saul went to the city of Amalek and set an ambush in the ravine. Then he said to the Kenites, Go away, leave the Amalekites, so that I do not destroy you along with them, for you showed kindness to all the Israelites when they came up out of Egypt. So the Kenites moved away from the Amalekites. Then Saul attacked the Amalekites all the way from Havilah to Shur to the east of Egypt. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with a sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and cattle, the fat calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, but everything that was despised and weak they totally destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel. I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Early in the morning, Samuel got up and went to meet Saul, but he was told, Saul has gone to Carmel. There he has set up a monument in his own honor, and he has turned and gone on down to Gilgal. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, The Lord bless you. I have carried out the Lord's instructions. But Samuel said, What then is this bleating of sheep in my ears? What is this lowing of cattle that I hear? Saul answered, The soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best of the sheep and cattle to sacrifice to the Lord your God, but we totally destroyed the rest. Stop, Samuel said to Saul. Let me tell you what the Lord said to me last night. Tell me, Saul replied. Samuel said, Although you were once small in your own eyes, did you not become the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and he sent you on a mission, saying, Go and completely destroy those wicked people, the Amalekites. Make war on them until you have wiped them out. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the sight of the Lord? But I did obey the Lord, Saul said. I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal. But Samuel replied, Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have violated the Lord's commands and your instructions. I was afraid of the people, and so I gave in to them. Now I beg you, forgive my sin and come back with me, so that I may worship the Lord. But Samuel said to him, I will not go back with you. You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel. As Samuel turned to leave, Saul caught hold of the hem of his robe, and it tore. Samuel said to him, The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. He who is the glory of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Saul replied, I have sinned, but please honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel. Come back with me so that I may worship the Lord your God. So Samuel went back with Saul, and Saul worshiped the Lord. So here we have a story of Saul sparing the best of the livestock and also the king, Agag. So it's been mentioned a couple times in the passage I read. The Amalekites were a group of people that had been the thorn in the flesh of the Israelites ever since they left Egypt. If you look at Exodus 17, 13 through 6, we see where this all started. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. And the Lord said unto Moses, Write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi, for he said, Because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. So this isn't just something that just happened, that the Lord told Saul to attack the Amalekites. This is something that goes back generations of where it was essentially prophesied that there would be war with Amalek and that the Lord wanted to wipe them out. Also, this would be the group of people that when the Israelites fought with them and Moses held his arms up, and when his arms were up, they were winning, and when he put his arms down, they started losing. That was also the Amalekites. So this is a group of people that is woven throughout this period of the Old Testament. A couple other thoughts. Verse 15:22. Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. I was struck by some similarities between this and the love chapter, specifically 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 3, where it talks about whether you can do all these mighty things and all these important, amazing things, but if you don't love, it's really more or less worthless. So those are some thoughts I had as I read this passage. And the mistake that Saul made here, I think it's fairly obvious to all of us, is that he did not fully follow the words of the Lord. He did some good things. He did destroy the Amalekites, mostly. But he did not completely destroy them. And even the fact that he wanted to save some of it to sacrifice to the Lord did not change the fact that he did not completely follow out the Lord's instructions. I have a quick story here that also kind of illustrates that. When I was a boy on the farm, my father once told me to do a certain thing one day that I really did not like to do. He went to town, and I noticed that our barn door really needed painting. I knew where there was a can of red paint and a new brush. I tried my hand at painting that door. I did a good job, but when my father came home, I do not need to tell you about it. It was not a precious memory. I performed a service, but I did not do the thing that my father left for me to do. So with the Christian, he will be rewarded, not for doing the things he wants to do, but for doing the things that Christ left for him here to do, to fulfill the Great Commission. So, again, Saul disobeyed, and not only did he disobey, he led his people into disobedience. God, through Samuel, had told him what to do. He did not tell the people. So as a leader, Saul also failed. At first, when confronted with this, he essentially tries to argue that he did follow the instructions of the Lord. And it takes several verses for him to either realize or admit that he did sin and make a mistake. And that's another thing we can learn. It is important to take responsibilities for our actions. I am once again reminded of a time, this time in my personal life. Back when I lived in Pennsylvania, I worked at Paul B's Hardware, which is a large hardware store, and I worked in the electrical section. And one day, a woman came back to the service counter and wanted to return a light bulb, and one of those big dusk to dawn light bulbs. And so they asked me to take care of that, and I walked over to the service counter, pulled the bulb out of its sleeve, and the bulb was burned out. It clearly was not a bulb that she had just purchased the other day. I should back up and mention the reason she was returning it, both her and her husband had each bought a bulb rather than just one of them, so they wanted to return the extra. So this bulb that I pull out that she wants to return is completely burned out. Not only that, it's not even a brand we sold. And I told the woman this, and she got angry. So I passed the buck. I went for the manager. And he told the woman the exact same thing, and she got angrier. And he passed the buck and went to the store manager. The first one would have been the department manager. And the store manager did the exact same thing, and she did the exact same thing, and she took her bulb, and she stomps off. The next day, the husband came in. She grabbed the wrong one. He had replaced the bulb, put the old bulb in the sleeve so it wouldn't break, and was intending to throw it away, and didn't. And when she came to return it, she grabbed the wrong bulb. So she grabbed the old bulb that had been replaced, and it was a pretty funny story to all of us in the store for quite some time. And this woman never did come back into the store, to the best of my knowledge. She made her husband come back and return the bulb. And that, to me, is a really good indication of what happens when we don't own up to our mistakes or don't take responsibility. Had the woman said, when I first told her, or even when my manager told her, you know, okay, I'll go back, check what happened. But she didn't. She kept insisting that we were trying to cheat her, essentially. And she simply would not listen to reason. And that has always stuck in my mind as an example of how not to handle mistakes. Along with that, one of the things I read in an article on retail when I was working at Paul B, when you make mistakes, and this was talking about in the retail industry, but it applies to all of us, and it's one of those things I think about a lot. People can accept that you made a mistake. That is human nature, and most people will not get upset about if you make a mistake. What they care about is how you handle it after you've made a mistake. Do you do what you can to make it right, or do you try to pass it off on someone else, pretend it never happened, all of those things? People remember that. So I'd like to look at some practical applications, things we can learn from this passage, which I have been going through some. The first one, it's pretty obvious, obey. Whether it's someone above you, whether that would be your parents, a teacher, pastor in the church, or someone out in the workforce, a boss, government, cops, listen to them. And something that my mom told me all the time, and I used to hate it when she said it because it was usually true, to delay is to disobey. Saying you'll do something later is not obedience. Also, partial obedience is not obedience. So that's the first section we're going to look at. Now we're going to switch gears again. We're going to look at 1 Samuel 22, 6 through 19. And here we find Saul chasing David around the countryside for no good reason, as far as I could figure out. Starting in verse 6. Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul, spear in hand, was seated under the tamarisk tree on the hill at Gibeah, with all his officials standing around him. Saul said to them, "Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why you have all conspired against me? No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited my servant to lie in wait for me as he does today." But Doeg the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's officials, said, "I saw the son of Jesse come to the Lord for him, and he also gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent for the priest Ahimelech, son of Ahitub, and his father's whole family, who were the priests at Nob, and they all came to the king. Saul said, 'Listen now, son of Ahitub.' 'Yes, my lord,' he answered. Saul said to him, 'Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and a sword and inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today?' Ahimelech answered the king, 'Who of all your servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard and highly respected in your household? Was that day the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Let not the king accuse your servant or any of his father's family, for your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair.' But the king said, 'You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your father's whole family.' Then the king ordered the guards at his side, 'Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because they too have sided with David. They knew he was fleeing, yet they did not tell me.' But the king's officials were not willing to raise a hand to strike the priest of the Lord. The king then ordered Doeg, 'You turn and strike down the priests.' So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down. That day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. He also put to the sword Nob, the town of the priests, with its men and women, its children and infants, and its cattle, donkeys, and sheep." So here again we see Saul make quite the mistake. He seems quite consumed by his hatred of David. He is chasing David around the countryside when he really should be back in Jerusalem ruling as a king ought to. Along with that, I did some research on Doeg the Edomite. He is mentioned quite a bit more in some of the Jewish writings, so you can take that as you will. That's not the Bible, but it does give some background information. Real briefly, he already has a grudge against David. There's some things that he holds against David, some things that very possibly never really happened, but he imagined that they did. So he was more than willing to side with Saul against David. He also was probably a very learned man, a man that knew quite a bit. Saul orders the priest to appear before him, and they come willingly. So if they came willingly, it stands to reason that they really did not know that they had done anything wrong. And in all honesty, they hadn't really. Saul claims that Ahimelech is lying and condemns them to death. His soldiers refuse to do so. Doeg is willing, and 85 priests are killed, and then the city of Nob is put to the sword by Saul. Somewhat interesting, Saul is perfectly willing to destroy completely one of his own cities here, but as we just read in the previous section, he was willing to spare the best of the livestock from the city of the Amalekites. Looking at some more practical applications here. First one, once again, is pretty obvious. Don't murder. But that goes a little bit deeper than it looks like on the surface. I want to look very briefly at 1 John 3:15, which says, anyone who hates his brother is a murderer, and you know that any murderer has no eternal life in him. So that makes it a little bit more applicable for each of us. I don't know that we're particularly tempted to murder someone. However, hate is a lot easier sometimes, it feels like. Along with that, Saul acted very hastily here. It's a good thing to learn that we should slow down when we're angry. Had Saul taken time to consider his actions, it stands to reason that he would not have done such an unwise thing here, such a terrible thing. And finally, the last application I want to take from this section is it's more important to obey God than man. Remember the group of soldiers, the footmen, that refused to kill innocent men. They disobeyed a direct order from the king, but they recognized the terribleness of this before. And finally, I'm going to look at one final section, one final mistake in the section is 1 Samuel 28, 3 through 25. Starting in verse 3. Now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in his own town of Ramah. Saul had expelled the mediums and spiritists from the land. The Philistines assembled and came up and set up camp at Shunem, while Saul gathered all the Israelites and set up camp at Gilboa. When Saul saw the Philistine army, he was afraid. Terror filled his heart. He inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him by dreams or Urim or prophets. Saul then said to his attendants, "Find me a woman who is a medium, so I may go and inquire of her." "There is one in Endor," they said. So Saul disguised himself, putting on other clothes, and at night he and two men went up to the woman. "Consult a spirit for me," he said, "and bring up for me the one I name." But the woman said to him, "Surely you know what Saul has done. He has cut off the mediums and spiritists from the land. Why have you set a trap for my life to bring about my death?" Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As surely as the Lord lives, you will not be punished for this." Then the woman asked, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" "Bring up Samuel," he said. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out at the top of her voice and said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." The king said to her, "Don't be afraid. What do you see?" The woman said, "I see a spirit coming up out of the ground." "What does he look like?" he asked. "An old man wearing a robe is coming up," she said. Then Saul knew it was Samuel and bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" "I am in great distress," Saul said. "The Philistines are fighting against me, and God has turned away from me. He no longer answers me, either by prophets or by dreams. So I have called on you to tell me what to do." Samuel said, "Why do you consult me now that the Lord has turned away from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done what he predicted through me. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to one of your neighbors, to David. Because you did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this to you today. The Lord will hand over both Israel and you to the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. The Lord will also hand over this army of Israel to the Philistines." Immediately Saul fell full length on the ground, filled with fear because of Samuel's words. His strength was gone, for he had eaten nothing all that day and night. When the woman came to Saul and saw that he was greatly shaken, she said, "Look, your maidservant has obeyed you. I took my life in my hands and did what you told me to do. Now please listen to your servant and let me give you some food so that you may eat and have the strength to go on your way." He refused and said, "I will not eat." But his men joined the woman in urging him, and he listened to them. He got up from the ground and sat on the couch. I think I'll stop there. So here we see Saul consulting a medium, one who communicates with spirits. A couple comments before I get into my definite thing here. This was a true medium. This was not someone who was pulling a trick or making it up as she went along. It seems pretty obvious that she was truly able to summon the spirit of Samuel. And Saul was able to speak directly with Samuel. And it would appear from the text that it's implied that the woman did not hear what the two spoke about. So I think it's pretty definite that this was someone who was a true medium. It's very possible that Samuel was in Sheol, the place of the dead. I don't have time to get into the linguistics of Old Testament places of death versus New Testament, but that's probably where he was at. Samuel is pretty strong with Saul, tells him that he's basically getting what he deserved. And Samuel foretells Saul and his son's death the next day in battle. So we're going to jump right into the practical applications here. The first one is more of a thought than an application. If God is silent in our lives, it's possible that the distance is between us and God is because of our actions. Now, I want to stress that's not always the case. Sometimes God is silent to test our faith. But in this case, Saul had essentially pushed God away from him, or God had moved away from Saul. And then the other application is the fact that people such as wizards and mediums are real, and the consequences for such actions are pretty serious. For want of time, I'm not going to dive into them, but there are multiple scriptures throughout the Bible that lay down harsh punishment for the sin of witchcraft and all the things that go along with it. And I want to bring back what I read in the first section, where rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. But it seems like more and more in the culture around us, magic in general is more common in our culture. For instance, Ouija boards, which are a way of communicating with the spirits, you can buy them on Amazon for less than $20, and they are made by Hasbro Games. Amazon so helpfully suggested that if I was interested in that, I might also be interested in purchasing the book, The Wicca Book of Spells, a book of shadow for Wiccans, witches, and other practitioners of magic for $6.99. So that's how accessible it is. And I mentioned Wicca there. Wicca is a religion. It's also known as pagan witchcraft. It's been around for about 75 years now, a little less. Technically, they would not be considered Satanists. However, their symbol would also be a pentagram. And they are becoming more and more, I guess you'd call it, pervasive in the culture around us and in the people around us. In 2007, the Department of Veteran Affairs added that pentagram to the list of emblems of belief that can be added to government-issued headstones on veterans' graves. Magic is all around us in media, books, movies, TV shows, games. Just did a quick Google search, and here are some very well-known young adult and children's books that include magic. I'm not going to comment on the worthwhileness or the use of such books, but I'm sure most of you will recognize most of these books. The Harry Potter books, the Magic Treehouse books, the Magic Schoolhouse books, Chronicles of Narnia, James and the Giant Peach, Lord of the Rings, and that's a very small sample size. And the final thing I want to talk about in this subject is Halloween. Mike might not want to talk about it, but I'm going to. Halloween is almost upon us, and by far this is when the magic side of things becomes very prevalent. So I want to look at the origin of the holiday itself very briefly, and also some of the origins of the traditions or practices around Halloween. Halloween itself is a shortened form of All Hallows Eve. All Hallows Day is November 1st. It's a day to celebrate and honor the dead saints who have died. Dead saints who have died is kind of redundant, I suppose. It is observed by the Roman Catholic, Anglican, and several Protestant denominations. Eastern Orthodox and Oriental Orthodox churches also observe it, but it is on a different date. The reason that All Saints Day is on November 1st is because it was chosen to replace a pagan holiday, which would have been the Celtic New Year, the festival of Samhain. So that is why it is on that day. The Celtic Druids, Druids would be people that basically worship nature. They believed that on this day, the souls of the dead, along with various demons and spirits, could mingle with the living. These evil beings would tease or play tricks on the living. A way to appease them was to offer candy or sweets to them, or another option was to disguise yourself as one of them to escape notice. Another thing that takes place on November 1st is it lasts from approximately October 30th to November 1st, is the Day of the Dead in Spanish-speaking countries, or Dia de Muertos. It's a very similar to this. It's a day to observe, to honor family members who have died. And this holiday, this type of holiday, can be traced back to the Aztecs. This is also a time that in the Roman era coincided with a harvest festival, giving thanks to Pomona, the goddess of fruit and nut trees. To celebrate, people often gave away fruit, which is probably where the tradition of bobbing for apples came from. And the last thing I want to look at as far as practice was the jack-o'-lanterns. These originate from Ireland. They are somehow connected with the story of Stingy Jack, a man who made a bargain with Satan and is now doomed to wander the earth with only a hollowed-out turnip to light his way. And to help him, people have put out hollowed-out turnips, and somewhere along the line, that transitioned to pumpkins. So those are some of the origins of Halloween. I think as Christians, we need to be very careful about any participation or anything even similar to Halloween. I think it's a way that things can sneak into our lives that we're not truly aware of the power of. But that is where I'm going to wrap it up. Brian, do we have a closing song? 390 in the Faith and Praise. Once you have that, you can stand. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I just pray for this day. I just pray that we could learn from the mistakes of Saul, Lord, and that we would be able to not repeat his mistakes, Lord. I just pray for each of these people this coming week as we go out and as Halloween is this week, Lord. I just pray that we would remain strong in our faith and stay away from the things that the world suggests are simply a fun fall festival, Lord. And Lord, I just pray for those who are in different places. I think of the ones down in Georgia working. Just bless them, and also Dale as he preaches. I just pray that you would give him the words to speak as well, Lord. And Lord, as we go from this place, I just pray that you would bless each of the people. In your name, amen.